When I was in high school, I hung out with a tall, skinny guy named Howard. His father had died when he was a child, and his mother worked as a legal secretary. Howard was a year older than I. His mother was an alcoholic. On the weekends, when she went out drinking with her friends, Howard would take the keys to her new powder blue Ford Fairlane, and we'd cruise the main drag, then drive out to the lake to get stoned. I remember one moonlit night, we were parked by the dock, when Howard closed his eyes, leaned forward, and asked me to kiss him. He said he wanted to know what it was like from a girl's point of view. I couldn't do it. At the end of his senior year, while his mother was dying from cirrhosis of the liver, Howard found out that he was about to inherit $1 million from his grandparents. We sat in his bedroom, drinking beer, and talking about what to do with the money. Howard said he wanted me to manage his affairs and suggested the possibility of opening a chain of New Age bookstores in the South Pacific, or creating the hottest dance club in the city, or forming a company that would make high-tech microprocessors for rock and roll instruments and amplifiers, which would be better than anything on the market that we'd sell to the biggest rock bands. We talked late into the night, and the next morning, sick and hungover, we'd go to a restaurant and drink coffee. The next weekend, we'd come up with some more business schemes. But of course, nothing came of any of them. Soon I went off to a local community college in order to prepare myself for life in the real world, and Howard received the inheritance and immediately rented a mansion on the coast and bought a Jaguar, a Mercedes, a BMW, a Triumph TR6 sports car, a couple of BSA and Harley-Davidson motorcycles, a 50-inch Hitachi television set, and top-of-the-line stereo equipment. He threw wild parties that sometimes lasted entire weekends. People smoked pot, downed various psychedelic drugs, did lines of coke, and drank until they passed out. When he wasn't driving around town or partying, Howard sat on his patio by the pool, drinking beer and reading books by Carlos Castaneda, or painted large oil canvases on his balcony overlooking the sea. He was beginning to foster the idea that he might have a career as an artist. After a number of years, Howard began to run out of money. One after another, he sold off the automobiles, the motorcycles, the large screen TV, the stereo, and then all his appliances and furniture and books and records and CDs. And eventually he ended up dead broke and homeless. By this time, I'd graduated from college. I had my first full-time job, and I was living in an apartment on the edge of town. Howard showed up at my door one evening and said, "Look, I was wondering if I could stay with you for a few weeks. I'm working on a couple of paintings to show to the Weller Gallery in Beverly Hills, and once I sell them, I'll be back on my feet. And if, for some reason, that doesn't work out, I can get a job as a commercial artist." I didn't know whether to believe him, but I really had no choice. He'd been a friend for years. So we moved in, stacked his canvases on my balcony, and slept on the convertible sofa in my living room. One morning, as I was leaving for work, after he'd been with me for about a week, he said, "I'll need a little money to shop for groceries. When you get home, I'll have dinner ready, and then we can watch television or go to the movies or whatever you want." He began to call me at the office to say, "We're having Cornish game hens tonight. What vegetables would you like? There's a Bergman movie that comes on at 9 we can watch after dinner. I know you like Bergman." During the day, he'd dust and vacuum and scrub and scour, and then he'd cook me dinner and do the dishes afterwards. Then he began driving me to and from my job so that he could use the car for buying groceries and for performing other daily errands. And soon, it was clear that his paintings were not going to be shown anywhere and that he wasn't about to look for a job. I was working for an importer of vases, wicker baskets, and wooden statuary that were wholesaled to boutiques and florists and high-end department stores. The company was owned and run by Earl Chapman, a middle-aged bachelor with a master's degree in Asian art. He was squat, balding, had a salt and pepper goatee, and usually wore African dashikis and sandals. A Chinese woman, Sandra, served as his business manager. She'd never quite learned how to use the computer, and once I saw him push her face up against the monitor and scream, "How many times do I have to tell you? Just read the screen! Just read the damn screen!" She was crying and begged him to stop and let her go. The other employees, who packed the merchandise for shipping, were also subject to Earl's violent temper. I'd started from the bottom, working on the loading dock, then had driven around in a company truck delivering merchandise to local businesses, and finally had begun composing copy for the catalog. Earl was so impressed by my writing that once he threw his arms around me and said, "This is just great. Maybe I ought to marry you." Another time, he came into my cubicle and read me a long passage from Orlando by Virginia Woolf. When he finished, he looked up from the page and said, "Isn't it wonderful? I think that's just beautiful writing." Then he walked off with an enchanted expression. A few minutes later, I heard him on the phone screaming at the manager of a boutique that had been delinquent in paying its bills. Then, one day around noon, Earl was eating a chicken sandwich he'd brought from home when he noticed some crunchy granules in it. He spat them out and looked inside to find methyl bromide crystals, an insecticide commonly used in shipping containers. When he realized that someone had slipped them in his sandwich in order to kill him, he told everyone to go home, except me, and broke down crying. "Everyone hates me," he said. "You're the only one who understands." Then, his body racked by sobs, he put his arms around me and tried to kiss me. I broke free and told him I had to go. Outside, Howard was waiting for me in the car. When I got in, I noticed he was wearing a silk robe with a sash and a pair of clogs. That's when I knew things were getting out of hand. I had to quit my job with Earl and get Howard out of my apartment. So that night, I told Howard I was planning a trip to Europe next month. I was going to sell the car, put my furniture in storage, and move out. Shaken, Howard went out onto the balcony to smoke a cigarette. I saw him weeping, his palm pressed to his forehead. Then he lifted his canvases and hurled them, one by one, into the street. I could hear them hitting the pavement below. Then he jumped. At work, the next morning, when I gave Earl 2 weeks' notice, he was furious. "You know what," he said? "You're worse than the rest of them, because you were pure, and still you betrayed me. You leave me no choice." He strode over to the garbage, retrieved the poison sandwich, and began eating ravenously. That afternoon, I drove up to San Francisco to visit my friends Vincent and Diane. Vincent and Diane and their 5-year-old daughter Katie lived in a Victorian on a hill above Golden Gate Park. They were all happy to see me. I moved into the guest cottage, formerly the garage, and in the evenings helped Vincent build a third-story deck on top of his house. During the day, I hung out with Diane. Diane had been the most beautiful girl in her high school class. She still had the long blonde hair, but her face was ravaged by drink. She told me that Vincent had forced her to become a mother, had robbed her of her dreams, and that he'd changed for the worse over the years. Now, she hardly knew him anymore. Their marriage was a sham. One day, while Vincent was away at work and Katie was at school, Diane fixed a lunch of shrimp scampi and salad. She'd been drinking white wine and brandy Alexander's. She said, "Lovemaking should be a feast. It should last all afternoon. I remember the first time I came with a man. I thought if I died right then, it wouldn't matter." Then she said, "You know, Vincent and I never make love." "Oh," I said. "I don't think he wants me anymore," she said. "I think I've lost my looks." "I don't think you have," I said. She said, "Thanks." Then she looked into my eyes and asked, "Would you like to make love to me?" I said, "I can't do that to Vincent." "That's what I thought you'd say," she said. "Everybody is always worried about Vincent." Then she took her wine glass and walked unsteadily into the other room. I stood there with a shrimp at the end of my fork. She came back in the room, walked up to me, and began clutching at my shirt, trying to tear it open. I grabbed her arms and said, "Doesn't anyone understand the nature of friendship?" She slapped me, began crying, and ran out into the garden. A moment later, I heard a shot. We'll be right back. gaze at the smoldering beauty of my purple eyes, the leonine mane of hair that I toss carelessly? Is it my long eyelashes? Is it my muscular volcanic energy? Is it my perfectly sculptured Greek body? Who knows? But they all find me irresistible. They want to touch me and rub up against me. They want a hair from my head, an article of my clothing. They want me to breathe on them. Is it my suave, sweet, utterly charming, disarming, and yet unassuming down-to-earth style? Is it the quality of my mind? The endlessly amusing, sometimes profoundly moving stories I tell? Is it my command of language? The depth of my insights, the sheer scope and range of my knowledge, the synthesis of my intellect as it ranges over a wide field of topics, able to discuss the manufacture of extruded molybdenum, Renaissance printmaking, various schools of Japanese sword making under the Taranga shogunate, the tempered scale before Bach, the history of aniline dyes, North African leather curing techniques, the flora of the Western Appalachian slopes, comb filter developments in digital tuners, and subatomic particles attendant to the cluster of black holes as postulated by Hawking? Is it because I'm a world-class expert in bioluminescence and have developed my own species of fluorescent porcupines? All I know is that my presence in a room is electrifying. I can see desire burning hotly like coals in people's eyes when they look at me. I can see them undressing me. The smoldering gazes of women compulsively crossing and uncrossing their legs, men grinding their molars while sweat forms in hot beads on their brows, teenage girls digging their nails into the palms of their hands, their lips parted, their eyes wet with desire. I was a magnificent baby, with pearly white teeth, creamy peach-colored skin, hands and feet perfectly formed. My ears were small shells, my lips a red flower. My face recalled cherubim, the most beautiful of choiring angels. I was, in fact, a perfect Renaissance painting of a baby. In grade school, next to me, all the other children looked plain, awkward, ugly, overpowered by the radiance of my physical beauty. A number of them actually committed suicide. The notes they left behind mentioned me by name. They said, "I can never be as beautiful as Joe. I can never be as perfectly realized as Joe. There's no point in living." The school was forced to organize seminars and focus groups, and the mayor appointed a board of eminent psychiatrists and social workers to raise the self-esteem of the children, which had been undermined by my presence. Yes, there is no one else like me. In the supermarket, I was at the counter when the checkout girl, looking at me, her pupils going wide and then up into her skull, fainted dead away. When I went to the cleaners to pick up my clothes, the woman behind the counter said she couldn't find them, but I was told by her 14-year-old nephew that in fact she had them at home and was keeping them for some votive or religious purpose. The very last time I took a taxi cab, the driver refused to let me out and drove me around back streets and freeways just for the pleasure of looking at me in the rearview mirror, never stopping anywhere until he ran out of gas. And when I climbed out of his cab, he pursued me, clutching at my clothes. The other day, I went to a coffee center and was set upon by a number of women who tore off my clothes and carried me to the Xerox machine, where they held me down against the glass in order to make multiple reproductions of my face, the undersides of my hands and feet, my buttocks, the soft under portion of my arms, the crook of my elbow, and the flesh behind my ears. Can you imagine how humiliating this was? It's impossible for anyone who hasn't lived in my skin to realize the moment-by-moment agony that I suffer on a daily basis. I remember a few weeks ago when I was presenting a financial summary for the restructuring of debt to leverage a corporate takeover, the executive vice president, an attractive woman in her late 30s, became entirely distracted. Her hands fidgeted and she bit her lip as her eyes raced up and down my body. I could feel the heat of her excitement through her clothing. And then, suddenly, she ripped open her blouse and skirt, the buttons cascading noisily on the surface of the highly polished conference table, and leapt at me. Her garter, having been caught on the underside of her chair, snapped her involuntarily back into place. But undaunted, she crawled forward, dragging the chair behind her, and grabbed me by my ankles. her mouth flecked with foam, her eyes wide and wild, her hair matted with perspiration. She begged me, "Take me right here on this floor, now. Give me your strength, your overwhelming tower of pleasure, the cathedral of your love. I need the vast ocean liner of pleasure of which you are the captain. You have no idea how many nights I've thought about making love to you. I need you so badly. To hold back from me is to ruin my life. All I ask is for simple union, to be one with you. Let our coming together produce the kind of critical mass bound for an earth-shaking explosion that will release potential never before imagined." I left the room because, as flattering as this sort of attention is, it distorts my life. It cheapens the quality of my existence. I can't even have a normal relationship anymore. Do I need to disfigure myself, take an acid bath, scar my face with a hot poker or a garden trowel? Once I went to a hospital ward of women who were blind. I did not speak, and yet my presence still created havoc. They leapt from their beds and crashed into walls, fell from their wheelchairs and lay writhing on the floor, reaching in all directions to find me, as though clutching for a life preserver thrown from the deck of a ship. I was forced to hide in a maintenance closet for 2 hours, until I was escorted out on a gurney, hidden beneath a pile of laundry, to a service exit. But I didn't escape unscathed, because once the orderly, a blonde intern, had successfully spirited me into the elevator, he leapt upon me and had to be pried from my body by a hospital administrator, who proceeded to kiss me deeply, her hands fluttering like butterflies up and down my chest. I fled with my clothes in tatters. Sometimes, when I come home to my apartment, I look out and see rows of people in the building across the way with binoculars, telescopes, video cameras, night vision enhancers, and parabolic microphones pointed in my direction. As soon as they see me, they become instantly animated. Can you imagine what it's like to see naked men and women dancing seductively and gesturing obscenely at you from their windows? Do you have any idea how awful this is? How my life has become a living hell? Oh God, why did you curse me with such a gorgeous face, such good health and strength? Why have you given me so many admirable qualities? You test my faith on a daily basis. These gifts are unendurable. If only you could restore me as someone else. A slightly overweight, plain, balding, middle-aged man, needing dental work, with a mild skin condition and a post-nasal drip. A man of average intelligence, an indifferent lover, with minor but nonetheless imminently pressing financial problems. For a while, I had my face bandaged as though I had been a victim of a terrible fire. I wore aviator glasses over the mummy-like gauze around my head, and gloves so that people wouldn't see the refinement of my hands, and stuck a pillow beneath my shirt in order to suggest I had a protruding gut, and wore an unkempt white wig, and affected a limp, and walked with a cane, and yet, in spite of that, I radiated an invisible energy I couldn't disguise and was set upon by a crowd of strangers in the street who piled on top of me, kissing and hugging and caressing me. It's awful. It's demeaning. It's as though people are handling an object, not a human being, which I am. I am a person. I am somebody. I am me. I feel as though I must flee, hide myself, turn off the light, pull the covers over my head and curl up in a fetal position in the attic, because I simply cannot go on any longer. It's too much to bear.
Joe, I had to call you now, and you have to listen to me. I need you now. Please, please come over here now. I need you now. Every time I see you walk across a room, I can't bear it that you're not coming to be naked and ready for me. I don't know what I can say to make you want me back, but I just have to have you, and I have to have you now. Please, 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 Joe.
If we make love, Joe, I know it'll be right, and the hell with everyone else. I really want you so much. It's so corny to repeat the same thing over and over again, but how do you get the heart to speak? We can be strong men, strong, virile, vital men, clasped together, grinding together, working together. And whether I'm on top, as I would prefer, or you are, it doesn't matter to me, but we can talk about the details later.
I've been thinking about your body. I've been thinking about running my fingers through your hair and touching your face and just kissing that mouth and putting my fingers on your eyelids and holding you really, really close to me and having you hold me. God, I just, that's all I think about. I can almost feel the weight of your body on top of mine. And that's just, I've got to have it. I've got to have the real thing really, really soon. Or I'm just going to do something crazy in the office one day. I'm going to do something crazy.
Joe, I have to have you. I can't wait any longer. It's driving me insane. I have to have you all to myself. I can't let anyone else go near you. I can't stand it when anyone else touches you. I'm so turned on, I can barely walk. I can barely eat or sleep or think. I feel almost nauseated with love.
I was looking out over the quad and you walked by, talking to that other woman. And I saw you and I wanted to run after you and tear her away and take you back with me.
Just the idea of my head being crushed between your thighs and looking up at your face, you know, seeing your face from that point of view, God. I don't want you to laugh at me because, you know, until you try it, you'll never know what it's like. I mean, no one will love you more than I will from that position. Is it asking too much? Is it really asking too much? I don't think it is. What can be unnatural about anything that happens between two people when they're in love, when they're alone together?
For some time now, I've been thinking about you in ways I know I shouldn't. And sometimes after I talk to you or even to see you for a cup of coffee or whatever, I will go home and I'll have to write in my journal. And my journal used to be about my life, and now my journal's about you. I just think about you. I think about what it would be like to do things with you, and I want you so badly. Ruining my life, tearing my life apart.
I was in North Redondo Beach. There was a bar on the corner with a neon sign of a martini glass with bubbles rising and a bright red cherry with a toothpick. I walked in. Some guys were shooting pool with a blonde in a buckskin jacket and jeans. In a hoarse voice, she belted out the lyrics to a song on the jukebox, and one of the guys said she could have been a great rocker. I sat down on one of the stools at the counter. The bartender came over. He said, "What'll it be?" "I'll have a shot of Old Taylor," I said. "Bad choice," he said, "but here it is." He poured me the drink and walked off. Two fat bikers came in and sat down at a table. After they rammed a few beers, they lit up a joint. When a Korean girl walked by, one of them grabbed her and pulled her onto his lap. "I want to buy this little chink a drink," he said. The girl was scared. She struggled as he tried to kiss her. I got up from the stool and walked over. I said, "Why don't you pick on someone your own size?" The biker turned and punched me. I felt a searing pain and went down. The bartender told the bikers to get out or he'd call the police. The bikers cursed and walked out. I heard them fire up their bikes and ride off. The blonde knelt beside me, dabbing at my bloody nose with a napkin. She said, "You did a good thing." She helped me up and into the bathroom. I washed my face in the sink. Then I pinched my nostrils until the bleeding stopped. She introduced herself. "My name's Nicole." Not long after, we left the bar together. She said, "I want to take you somewhere." We got on our motorcycle and rode to her old high school. Then we climbed over a chain-link fence and walked to where the school's Olympic-sized pool was shimmering, lit by blue underwater lights. She said, "Let's get naked." I said, "I don't think so." She put her arms around me and said, "Don't worry, Grandpa. I won't get you in any trouble." Then she kissed me. While I stood fully clothed by the side of the pool, Nicole climbed the ladder and stood nude at the end of the diving board. "If I dance for you," she said, "will you throw dollar bills at me, like they do with the girls in the clubs?" I said, "Yes." She began to dance, looking at me the whole time. Then she dove in the water and surfaced right next to me. "Are you sure you don't want to come in?" she said. We rowed back to her house. She invited me out for a beer. The furniture in her apartment looked as if it had been fished out of a trash dumpster. There were cigarette burns everywhere. Sitting on her couch, she said, "When I was a little girl, my parents used to take me to an old amusement park at the end of a pier. There was a house of mirrors that was like a maze. Some of the glass was clear, and some was mirrored. You could really get lost in there. It was scary. Then, one day, in the sun's reflection in one of the glass panes, I saw the face of a beautiful man. I know it sounds crazy. I had no idea who you were, but I knew that someday we'd meet." Then she asked me to stay the night. "I'm sorry," I lied, "but I've got a girlfriend." She asked me, "What does she do?" "She's a nurse," I said. "We work together." "What do you mean?" "I'm a doctor." "You're kidding," she said. "We're very compatible," I said. "We have similar interests. We can talk about medicine." "I can talk about medicine too," she said. "Rolaids consumes 47 times its weight in excess stomach acid." "True," I nodded. "You're not really a doctor," she said. "That's just a lot of bull. But go on. You can leave if you have to." "I'm sorry," I said. I was walking back to the bar where my car was parked when I heard an engine racing. I turned, saw Nicole on her bike headed straight for me, and dove behind a parked car. The bike hit the car, spun around, skidded across the pavement in a shower of sparks, and exploded in flames.